You're listening to Two Girls, One Crossword.
Took us a long time to get recording today, but we're here.
We're here. Back again.
Back again. It's nice to be back in the studio after traveling last week.
World traveler over here.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for allowing us to take a week off. We are...
A single week off. We're allowed to do that once in a while.
Yeah. We get 1 week off a year. No. You guys, you know, we take weeks off. But sometimes you got to. I mean, you got birthdays, you got trips.
You got this, you got that. I mean, this is a weekly podcast where we don't get paid to do it. This is truly just a hobby of ours. Fun little thing that we do. We put
a hobby that stresses me out every week. I'm like, gotta do research.
Literally, we pour hours and hours of our life into this podcast. Not that we need to make money off of hobbies, but like what I'm trying to say is we are allowed. Our payment is our weeks off when we take
Who are we saying this to? Like, no one has told us that we can't take a week off. Everyone's always like, okay, see you next week.
We're trying to, I think we're reality checking with ourselves. Because sometimes we feel guilty. Like, and you and I are talking about, like, well, can we take this time off? Can we do this? And it's like, literally no one has ever once written angrily to us. And it's not like we have, like, a producer breathing down our neck saying we can't take time off. Like,
no.
It's us. Well, it's the voices in our head.
Sometimes people do say, like, oh, I feel like people said they missed it because it's like a weekly ritual for them to listen. Yeah. So we love that for you. But we know that those listeners also understand that we need a break. So
you better.
I'm not going to beat myself up over it. So breaks or not, this is Two Girls, One Crossword. I'm Grace Topinka.
I'm Chelsea Rowan. And this is your favorite weekly Podword Crosscast where we do take the occasional week off.
Weekly, most of the time.
Mostly not all the time. Weekly. I would say this is like, you know, if we're talking 52 out of 52, we're hitting like 48 out of 52 a year. Something like that.
You think? I don't know. I don't know about that. Might be like more like 45. Because what episode? I feel like we're like on episode 200. We've been doing this for like 3 years.
We've been doing this for like 5 years straight. Yeah. We have like four episodes.
The math's not adding up. We've been skipping.
The math's not mathing. So whatever.
All right. Well,
okay, that's it. We have to stop talking about this because I don't want nightmares tonight, and you know that I have nightmares about this.
We don't, we have to try and prevent any stress dreams. Well, let's get into our Polapalooza from 2 weeks ago based on Chelsea's topic of martinis and other liqueurs.
Ooh.
We asked our Twitter followers to pick their poison: rum, vodka, gin, or whiskey. And I guess our Twitter followers are pretty cool because with the number one choice with 46% was whiskey. Believe it or not.
I will not, but okay.
In second place with 27%, we had vodka.
Vodka?
In third place with 18%, we had gin.
With how much percent?
18.
Okay.
And then 9%, last place, we had rum. So
okay, I'm really holding back here. I don't want to shame anybody, even though I completely disagree with basically most of our listeners.
What? Whiskey is cool.
I'm not saying whiskey isn't cool.
I wish I liked whiskey.
Exactly. What I'm saying is I'm shocked that vodka beat gin. Vodka has zero taste. Zero. Gin has a flavor to it.
Sometimes you want zero taste. Like if you're just trying to get drunk.
Maybe our listeners are just trying to get drunk.
Down the gullet easiest, and sometimes that's vodka. In my opinion, it's rum, a little Malibu coconut rum.
Oh no! I have. There are certain liquors that are triggering to me. They trigger that gag reflex, not to like freak anybody out, but like seriously, like for instance, Bacardi Dragon Fruit Rum.
Mm-hmm. You had a bad experience. Too much.
One time, the worst I've ever been drunk. The worst I've ever been hungover. Yes, I was in high school, but I was young enough.
High school.
I was young enough for that to sit in my brain and literally eat me alive for years. Anytime I think about rum, I smell rum, I get that just the flashback comes back and it's not good.
I'm not a big drinker and I really don't care that much about alcohol, but I do feel like rum is my favorite because my favorite drinks are like mojitos, rum and Coke.
Mm-hmm.
Two rums, baby.
Two rums can't make a right, but they'll certainly make you some wrongs.
T-shirt idea. We need to own up a t-shirt shop. Because I was thinking...
We should actually release merch. What do you think?
Just for us to buy. But yeah. I feel like we could have Mayor LaGuardia versus the pinball machine.
Yes.
In like a WWE... Or what is it now? No, it's WWE now.
Yeah.
Like kind of style. Anyways.
Listeners, any graphic designers that? Out there? Maybe we can commission. Well, commission. We love you. We respect the art, but we're poor as well. So like, let's broker a deal here. You know what I'm saying? You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Sweet deal. Let us know. But that was Pulpalooza. So
wow. Okay.
Congrats to everyone who can drink whiskey.
That nobody likes gin. I don't know.
Isn't it cooler that other people don't? Like, you kind of want to be...
That is, like, yeah. You know. I kind of, like, it feeds my Aquarius ego of, like, just being a little strange for people.
Yeah. I guess if you want to be really strange, you'd be, like, me and, like, rum, but...
Sorry, that just reminds me of Captain Jack Sparrow.
I went through a period of time where I was obsessed with pirates.
Yeah.
It was like at the camp I went to, everyone loved pirates. Yeah. And I burned a pea onto my wrist with salt and ice because they used to do that to pirates. We like taped a pea and did salt and ice. And I thought it was going to go away after like 5 weeks. Well, it lasted for like a year. So I was home like outside of camp where that's not normal. I feel like my mom saw it. She's like, what is that?
What is that?
Anyways.
The things kids do because of pirates.
That's me and rum.
So what's next?
Shall we go into our heights and shites?
Heights and shites. I actually have some crossword news for the world.
Dun, da, da, da. Get your crossword news here.
You heard step it here right first. On up. So the ACPT is coming up this weekend. If you don't know what the ACPT is, it's the annual American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. This year will be the 44th year that they're hosting it. It's hosted in person at some hotel in Stamford, Connecticut. Grace and I will not be attending, but I will be attempting to strong-arm Grace into doing the virtual crossword tournament after the puzzle. Like, I think they do, like, a post-tournament, like, virtual thing where you can, like, download the puzzles and do them at home. Mm-hmm. And, like, see where you like, land in the standings. Because, one, Grace and I have plans this weekend, so we couldn't possibly even do the virtual one, like, live. But maybe we could do them live... After. Later live.
The truth is, we're too scared. First of all, we're not good enough to compete with these people.
I've done it once, and it really confirmed that I was not good enough. There was a Brooke Husick puzzle, and the theme was something about science, and I kid you not, I think I left 99% of the puzzle empty. So, thank you for that. That was like, it was a reality check in a way. Like, it just kind of brought me back. It humbled me a little bit. Brought me back to my senses, as it were.
I really feel like it's good to be humbled, though, every once in a while.
You have to be, because...
I'm constantly humbled. That's why I'm so great.
Anyway, if you're interested in attending the ACPT this year, you can show up to this hotel in Stamford, Connecticut, and sign up in person and do the puzzles in person and, like, have a lot of fun there. It is April 1st through the 3rd. You can just Google ACPT and figure out the exact address of this hotel in Stamford, Connecticut that I keep dancing around because I don't have that information. But the next big piece of news, probably, you know, I know people are excited about the tournament, but this is probably the most exciting news for me, and I think for you. We learned this week that the New Yorker crossword is expanding. If you have been doing the New Yorker puzzle long term, like Grace and I have been doing, it used to just be three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The puzzles got progressively easier, so it was reverse of, you know, New York Times. They are now doing one puzzle for every day of the week. I'll read you a quick little excerpt from their press release, or like their article on their website. Quote, the New Yorker crossword is expanding. You can now solve a new crossword every weekday, Monday through Friday, on our website or in our app. Mondays through Thursdays, we'll publish themeless puzzles that decrease in difficulty throughout the week with a new beginner-friendly puzzle on Thursdays. You'll also find something new on Fridays, a themed puzzle of light to moderate difficulty. That's huge. New Yorker does not do any themes. So I'm really excited for tomorrow. We record on Thursdays, as you probably know. Tomorrow, they're going to drop their first themed puzzle. Very excited.
New Yorker puzzles are fun. I feel like they're a little, I don't know, edgier sometimes. They're edgier. New York Times.
Yes, like today, or was it Wednesdays? I forget whatever Brooke Husick's puzzle was this week on New Yorker. I felt like so many of her clues were like woman themed, which might not seem like a big deal, but like when the opener is like coat you put on before foundation and the answer is primer, like that is the opener of your puzzle. You would like really never see that in New York Times because old white men would never know what a primer is.
They'd be like, no one knows what that is.
Exactly. Nobody except 53% of the population, or how many women are there in the world now? Are we at least less than men?
2, 3. There's us.
Anyway, also really cool about this is that the New Yorker has like a rotating kind of like pool of constructors, and they're adding new constructors to that rotation, which is very exciting. The three new constructors are Brooke Husick, who we love. She has puzzles in all of the publications that we do, you know.
You said her name like 10 times this episode.
Brooke. I'm obsessed. Although I did hate that science puzzle, but not because it was bad. It was because it was really, really good. Then Will Nettinger and Paolo Pasco, who is another favorite of ours. So congrats, guys. We're very excited for you. We're excited for the New Yorker because I love doing the New Yorker. I prefer it over the New York Times. So now I have something I can do every day. Yeah, like,
but I feel like their app is not friendly, user-friendly.
I've never
like the way they
that.
Have the crosswords listed, they need to change it, in my opinion. Because you just have to, like search it, like you're searching for an article. It's like, you should have them all listed. Maybe I'm looking at it wrong on the app. Someone tell me if
all
I
right,
am.
Help us out. But the New Yorker is also one of the few puzzles where you can do like partner mode.
Yes. So that's fun. Chelsea and I do that. And then we FaceTime and do the puzzle at the same time.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what I got for news. Maybe you should take us into the actual puzzles from the last week.
Sure. Okay. Well, I did some. I have some from this week, some from the week before. The Wednesday, March 30th, New York Times by Jack Murtaugh. I like 26 across. Need an arc? I know a guy and others. But Noah was spelled N-O-A-H. And the answer was puns.
Nice.
And then I learned something new with 5 down. Climb up as a pole. I had S-H-I blank blank Y, and I was like, oh, it has to be shimmy, like you shimmy up a pole.
Mm-hmm.
But it was shinny with 2 N's. And I was like, what is that? So then I Googled it, and according to the dictionary, shinny is another term for shimmy. Why? Why do we need 2 words?
Why do we need 2?
They mean the same thing, that are just slightly different.
That, like, literally, it's just we're off by a single hump of a letter. You know what I mean?
I wonder if it's, like, a regional thing. Like, some places use shinny. Some use shimmy.
Well, we had this kind of come up in one of the New Yorkers. I think it was something like anonymous name, and the answer was doe, but it came up twice. One answer was doe, and one answer was something I had never heard before.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's not true. It's just something I've never heard before. And I can't remember it off the top of my head. I did not retain the new information. But
sometimes we can't retain everything.
It's true. It's true. What do I got? Let's start with the Friday, March 25th, New York Times by Evan Clichy. 17 across.
Kalish?
No, it is not Kalish. Oh. It's not Evan Kalish. I thought it was, but then it's spelled C-L-I-C-H-Y, I believe.
His arch nemesis.
Yes. 17 across. Not be completely open with everyone, to put it mildly. And the answer was lead a double life.
Ooh.
Okay.
Drama.
Exactly. And then 60 across, mantra in the face of criticism. And the answer was haters gonna hate.
That's funny.
Although I originally had sticks and stones in and it fit, and I was really hoping it was sticks and stones, but I mean, haters gonna hate was just as nice. And then I liked this one, 42. I think this was down. I'm sorry. Cleared one's cookies, ? And the answer was 8, A-T-E.
I remember that one.
It's a good one.
I have some from that puzzle as well.
Okay.
I liked 8 across. They might help with the dishes.
Oh, the recipes.
Recipes.
Yeah.
I also liked led a double life because it was so, but it's like the 15. Sometimes it's like, man, that phrase is 15 letters. How lucky.
I know.
33 across, exam where 100 is not a perfect score. IQ test.
Yes, I knew it was IQ something. I couldn't remember. It was like IQ exam, but exam was in the clue. I can't remember what the answer was.
And then this one reminded me of like a riddle. 44 down. Something that's thrown out while using it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
An anchor.
It was good. It was a good one. It's a good puzzle. I liked a couple from the Saturday, March 26th New York Times by Ashton Anderson and James Mulhern. The opener was fun. One across, wave one's arm, question mark. Or wave one's arms, question mark. And the answer was brandish. It's just a good, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like to, anyway. Uh-huh. And then 34 across, horizontal group hug session.
Orgy?
Great guess, but it was cuddle puddle, which I'd never heard before. It was just cute. Yeah.
Cuddle puddle?
Yeah.
I've heard, yes. I've heard that. You actually don't watch a lot of videos of, like, kittens and puppies.
No. Well, wait, I do, but I've never once heard cuddle puddle.
Hmm. We must be running in different crowds.
We are. We are. Truly. What else you got?
I liked the Monday, March 28th New York Times theme by Leslie Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fun, and I hadn't seen it before, so 16 across, the first one was Q's. But it was like Q.U.E.U.E.S.
Oh, yes. This was a good puzzle.
And so, yeah, that answer was dotted lines because a Q is a line and there's dots between it. So then 27 across was extras with the plus sign in between. And it was added bonuses. 44 across was wheels with a slash. And it was slashed tires.
Yep.
58 across was dreams with dashes in between it. And it was dashed hopes.
It was good.
Yeah. It reminded me, like, did you ever used to do that, those, like, visual puzzles in school? It'd be, like, mind, line, matter. And it was, like, mind over matter. You had to, like, figure out what the image was saying.
Isn't that called an AWL, an AWL puzzle?
Could be. Could very well be.
I might have just made a fool of myself live on air. If I got that wrong, let me know.
Would not be the first time either of us has done that, so don't worry about it.
Did you do the Sunday, March 27th New York Times?
I didn't.
I think you would really like this one. The theme was so much fun. I feel like there are probably people in the cross world that do not like themes like this, but this is a theme that you and I, we just eat the shit right up. This is for, specifically for us. I feel like in the byline it should have said, like, attention, Grace and Chelsea. This was by August Lee Kovach, or Kovach. The theme was Khufu. So, essentially, there were circled squares within the grid that made a big triangle, and the circled squares spelled out the Great Pyramid of Giza. Inside the big triangle, there was a black box that had, what is it, five white squares in it that eventually you would fill in to read K-H-U-F-U, Khufu, who is the Pharaoh buried in the Great Pyramid of Giza, right?
Oh my gosh.
And so the whole theme was based around the Great Pyramids, around Egypt, tombs, crypts, the whole thing. It was a lot of fun. So I'll read you some of the themed answers. Five down, with 51 across and 15 down, group in which the circled letters is the only one still largely intact. And the answer was seven wonders of the world. And seven wonders of the world spanned across five down, 51 across, and 15 down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, the Great Pyramid of Giza is one of the only large, like, still intact, which is really fun. Then you have 41 across. Approximately 5.5 million tons of these, of it, was used to build the circled, you know, so the Great Pyramid. Mm-hmm. And the answer was limestone. And then 10 down, Greek's name for this puzzle's enclosed answer, the enclosed answer being Khufu, and the Greek name for Khufu is Cheops, C-H-E-O-P-S.
Mm-hmm.
And then 74 down, with 101 across, where this puzzle's enclosed answer is located, and this answer was King's Chamber. So, of course, he's located in the King's Chamber.
That's so good.
I know, it's so much fun. And then 79 down, number of 101 acrosses in the Great Pyramid. And the answer was three. So the number of chambers in the Great Pyramid, three. It was so good. It was so much fun. When we filled in, because we were reading and we were like reading all the clues and we were like, I'm like, this has to be the Great Pyramid of Giza. And so we're like, just try it. Just put them in. Just put it in. And we had nothing else really filled in. And it fit. And we're like, okay, let's just keep it in and like see what happens. And then Matt was like, I think Khufu, I don't know how to pronounce it, is the pharaoh in there. So we filled that in too. And it all came together. It was a lot of fun.
It all came together as it always does.
Would recommend. And like I said, Grace and I eat that shit up. We love puzzles like that.
We really do. Any like visual picture in
we're
the
like,
puzzle?
Ooh, nice.
Ooh, a panda.
Yeah. What else you got, kid?
Speaking of fun, like 15 across, you know, words or phrases that just happen to be 15 letters, The Monday, March 21st by John Eubank and Jeff Chen. This was like the center across, 39 across, reality star sister of Kim and Courtney. Khloe Kardashian. It's 15 letters.
It's nice.
And then a quick shout out to the Thursday, March 31st New York Times by Oliver Roeder, 62 across. What, quote, should be made by filling a glass with gin, then waving it in the general direction of Italy, per Noel Coward. Dry martini.
Nice. That's cute. Well, yeah, because a martini. Anyway, we went over this last
episode.
We've
been over martinis.
You'll have to listen to the last episode. Grace and I got to do a puzzle together this week. We did the Tuesday New Yorker by Paolo Pasco, his debut in the New Yorker. And honestly, Grace and I will drop anything whenever we see Paolo's puzzles published. This was fun. I really liked 14 across. Accessory that might pop. And the answer was balloon hat. I feel like that is like such a camp accessory. Like we could just make like wear a skirt, right? And then make a balloon skirt to go over it. It's kind of like Tiny Jewish Girl on TikTok. I feel like she could wear balloon accessories like legitimately.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so could we.
We could try. Don't know if we'd pull it off, but.
No, we could absolutely do it. Whether or not it works is to be seen. Also, 16 across, idyllic pastoral aesthetic is cottagecore, which it's fun to see cottagecore in the crosswords. I also liked four down, spots where Persian cuisine is served, ? And the answer was cat dishes.
Mm-hmm.
So cute. And then I liked 31 down as well, opportunity to go and learn something, class trip. I feel like I have so many like vivid memories from class trips.
King Tut, both of us saw King Tut.
We both saw King Tut. Isn't that crazy? It's crazy.
Small world out there.
It really is. It's a very tiny, tiny world out there. Where do you go for class trips in Florida? Not to be like weird, but like I lived close to New York and Philadelphia, you know what I mean? So I got to go to
We go to Animal Kingdom.
Oh, right.
Disney World. We went to Disney World, Anne's Adventure, the Everglades.
The other cultural epicenter was Disney. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. When we were little, it was like the zoo, parrot jungle.
Okay.
Lots of outdoor animal stuff.
We were so close to Philly that we were like doing, you know, this is where the Declaration, I don't know. This is a Liberty Bell, and this is the Ben Franklin Institute museums and stuff like that. So,
yeah, we didn't really, I feel like we didn't do anything. Like King Tut was a big one. We did like the Holocaust Museum. There's a big one in Miami. But other than that, I mean, St. Augustine is the only like really historical thing in Florida where they have the Fountain of Youth, which we talked about.
Of course.
In another episode, but that's far from Miami, so.
Mm-hmm. And we were, like, close enough to do Washington, D.C. I was in, like a law class in high school, and our
in
teacher
third
was...
grade?
Yeah, in third grade. I was in the Gifted and Talented program. And our teacher took us down to Washington, D.C. to, like, try to get into the Supreme Court hearing or whatever, and we didn't make it in, but we got to, like, go around the I don't even remember, it was
the mall.
So long ago. Yeah, but we were inside the building and like it was really cool.
That's
and we tried
because cool.
You can like they let in so many people like from the public to witness like Supreme Court rulings and things like that. And we didn't make the cut to get in. So we were just like in the building. And then I think there's like a gift shop. Yeah, that was fun. That was like an interesting thing that sometimes I forget that I did.
Well, if the fifth in my elementary school, fifth grade got to go to D.C. That was like the big fifth grade trip. But when I was in fifth grade, 9/11 happened. So we didn't end up doing that. Instead, we saw like Scooby-Doo and went to Bubba Gump Shrimps on like, what's it called? Baywalk? No. If you live in Miami, you know where we went. And then that's what we did instead of going to D.C. So
I'm sorry. It's not funny, but it is kind of funny that instead of Washington, D.C., you went to Bubba Gump's Shrimp. I love that.
And we saw this weird Scooby-Doo play, and that was it.
It was a play?
It was a live performance, yeah. I don't remember what else it was, but I do remember going to Bubba Gump Shrimp. And we thought, no, it wasn't. It wasn't.
Weird.
Anyway. Thanks, 9/11.
Thanks a lot. That's all I have.
That's all I have. Shall we flip the coin and get into
time to flip it?
Topics? Yes.
Yes. Grace had a moment of panic today that we might have the same topics. We do not. Apparently, we had our people. She had my people connect with her people. It was like a whole thing. Anyway, so let's see. I'm flipping the coin now. It's heads.
All right. Congratulations.
Let's do it. So my topic comes from the Monday, March 28th, New Yorker by Will Nediger. 21 down. In the mail, say? ? And the answer is armor clad, as in chain mail. So I'm talking about armor today. You know, like chain mail, body armor.
Yeah. Okay. I wear some at all times.
She does. She's wearing some right now. Head to toe, full suit armor.
I have like toe socks, but armor. Individual.
She gets them real spread. Yeah, we're talking about armor today, and I'm kind of excited about it. There's lots of pictures involved. So let's jump right into it. So armor, and I want to make this distinction because I think it's hilarious. It can be spelled the British way or the American way. So if you're British, you might spell it with a U, A-R-M-O-U-R. Or if you're American, you drop the U, okay? And armor is protective clothing that has the ability to deflect or absorb the impact of projectiles or other weapons that might be used against a person's body. We're going to be focusing mainly on, well, exclusively on, personal armor, which is what's used to protect soldiers or war animals. But the word armor can also refer to vehicle armor, or in some cases, it could just mean arms, like as in weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we're talking about personal armor,
mm-hmm.
body armor, not BTS army, just armor. So the word armor first appeared in the Middle Ages. It's derived from the Old French armure, which comes from Latin armatura, meaning arms and or equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So while we're focusing on personal armor, I just want to say that we're going to talk mostly, well, exclusively, about historical armor. We are not talking about contemporary body armor, so we're not talking about Kevlar or any of that nonsense. Let's get started. Armor usually falls into three main categories. The first category is armor made from leather, fabric, or mixed layers of both. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Category two, mail, also known as chain mail, is made of interwoven rings of iron or steel or some other metal. Category three is rigid armor made of metal, horn, wood, plastic, or some other tough material. And this includes plate armor, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And it's what knights in Europe would have worn during the Middle Ages. And we'll talk about plate armor, suits of armor. We'll get there. Okay, so just wait. I know you guys are just dying for it, but just wait.
I feel like I'm in a video game, like picking the different options for...
Yes. So this topic came at a perfect time because I'm currently obsessed with a game called Valheim where I'm playing like a Viking. It's essentially like Minecraft, but set in like a more realistic looking world, and you're a Viking and... you can like upgrade your armor and things like that. And I basically spend all of my time upgrading my armor and building stone towers. Like that's all I do.
She basically is a Viking.
Exactly. So that's what I'm playing right now. But I also finally bit the bait and I downloaded Elden Ring for the PS4. Everybody's talking about it. And honest to God, the reason I downloaded Elden Ring is because people keep posting TikToks of their really fucking cool armor that they can have their characters wear. And I'm like, that's so cute. I want to do that. So.
She's got armor on the mind.
It's on the brain.
No doubt she would pick this topic.
So it's topical. Exactly. All right. So The history of armor is vague in that it's assumed that armor and protective clothing dates beyond historical records. So beyond like anybody ever talking about armor. So there is no way of, quote, knowing who invented armor or any of that. But it is accepted that while technology may not have been advanced, even like primitive or early like civilizations would have, of course, found some way or another to protect their body from the elements, from different warfare situations, from animals, that kind of thing. So Grace, can you please open the document? I'm sending Grace a document that has a bunch of pictures of armor so that she can have like a visual. I'm going to try and find a way to incorporate these into the edit of the YouTube video so you can watch it on YouTube. You'll see some of the pictures that I'm talking about. And then if I ever update Instagram again, I will put these on Instagram as well. So
stay tuned.
Stay tuned for more. Or you can just put this on and open up Google and do some searching as I'm talking. Okay. So we'll start with the first category of armor, which is made from leather or fabric, etc. It's assumed that the first ever armor was used by primitive warriors, and it would have been leather hides and helmets. In 11th century BCE, Chinese warriors wore armor made of 5 to 7 layers of rhinoceros skin, and the Mongols in the 13th century CE would wear armor of ox hides. In the 5th century BCE, Greek infantry would have worn multi-layered linen cuirasses, which is essentially just a shirt that goes from the neck to the waist. So if I say a cuirass, it's a neck to the waist shirt of some sort of armor material. And then in northern Italy, they wore quilted linen coats as protection until the 19th century. The first picture, Grace, on that document is of the Chukchi people of Siberia, and they use a type of armor that's made from shaved seal skin, and it's formed into a type of ring, which they would shape around a wooden skirt. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then they would wear that from the waist to the feet. And the rings of leather grow thicker and thicker from the waist all the way down. And that's then, like, cool. You can see that the leather also, they have like a big leather back plate that kind of looks like wings, and it comes up behind their head as well. So it's this big protective, like, leather garment. It's very cool. Sorry you can't see it if you're listening to us on the radio, folks.
Just picture it in your mind's eye.
Use your imagination. Let's see. So fabric and leather armor was flexible, and layers of cotton and cloth would provide padding against blunt attacks, but could otherwise be vulnerable to sharper weapons. So, which advanced, like, as metalsmithing became a thing. Mm-hmm. And as is the way with most things, with technological advances, weaponry advances, so did the need for better body armor. So now I'm going to be talking about categories 2 and 3 of armor: mail armor and rigid armor. There is literally so much to talk about, Every single civilization has their own unique armor history. So what I'm going to do is kind of define different types of armor and, like, highlight one or two examples of armor within those categories, okay? Let's begin. Mail, or chainmail. It's a type of armor that consists of small metal rings linked together in a pattern to form a mesh-type fabric. It was common in military use between the 3rd century BCE and the 16th century CE, maybe even longer, and it's an invention that is credited to the Celtic people. Chainmail was a massive improvement on leather and fabric armor, as you can imagine. It provided an effective defense against slashing blows, blows from, like, swords or blades, and even penetration blows from, like, spears. So coming from above or just poking. There's actually a study done at the Royal Armory in Leeds, which concluded that if you use, like, typically any medieval weapon against chainmail, it was, like, what they said is, it is almost impossible to penetrate using any conventional medieval weapon. So chainmail was really important and a really big advancement from, like, leather or, like, quilted linen. Imagine, but hey, God, I can't imagine, like, ever needing to be on a battlefield, let alone have to, like, wear quilted linen to fight like
all right, good luck, here's a robe.
Try your darndest, right? So chainmail's protectiveness is determined by 4 factors. The first is the type of link. So there's 3 different types of link that were common in medieval times: riveted, butted, or welded. So budded rings are rings where each end are brought together, and the only thing that holds them together is the strength of a ring. So imagine having like a piece of iron, and then you use pliers to like make a circle, and it just stays in a circle, right? That is a budded ring. Then you have a riveted ring, which both ends of the circle overlap, and there's a pin to keep them together. Okay. And then you have welded rings, which are both ends of the iron are pulled together, and then they're welded together.
I'm getting the welded one for myself, personally.
Honestly. But, like, could you imagine, first of all, making a full shirt of chainmail? And now, not only that, but you have to do, you're doing riveted ones, so you put the circles together, and then you have to have a tiny little pin to connect each one. There are thousands of little rings in one shirt, okay? And now you got an army of, like, 10,000. You're just hammering away here. God, I am so grateful that I am not a blacksmith. That is a fact. That is a fact. Okay, and so you have these rings, right? And they are put, the shirts are put together in a 4-to-1 ratio. What I mean by that is one ring has to be connected to another 4 rings. Okay, that's standard. We got a visitor.
Sorry.
You have to get off. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Arnold.
He could sit on my lap, but he purrs too loud. So what am I going to do?
He's got to go. He's got to go. She said it once. She said it twice. He's got to go. Okay. So that is the first determining factor of how effective chainmail will be, okay? And then the second is the type of material used. From weakest to strongest, you have bronze, iron, or steel. The next is the weave density. So a tighter weave needs a thinner weapon to surpass it. So, like, the tighter the weave, the harder it is to stab through. The wider the weave, like, the bigger, like, and, like a massive, blunt little sword can be like, whonk.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's real tight, that big, big sword's not coming through, right? And then the ring thickness itself of the actual chainmail. So generally, the rings range from 1.02 to 1.63 millimeters in diameter. It's really small in most examples, okay? So if you could afford it, chainmail provided a huge advantage on the battlefield as opposed to, like, the hide of your recent dead cow. Chainmail could be made into many different garments, leggings, hoods, mittens, collars, shirts of varying lengths. A hauberk was a knee-length shirt made of chainmail. A hobergen was a mid-thigh shirt made from mail. And a jazerant was a layer or layers of chainmail sandwiched between layers of fabric.
Wow.
So there's tons of different things that you could do with chainmail. If you look at that document, Grace, you'll see I have included a hobert picture, which is essentially just, you know, a shirt from neck to knee. And that's the chainmail. The term for chainmail in Japan is kusari gosuku, and it was used extensively by samurai starting from the time of the Mongol invasions in the 1270s. Kusari were made from rings that were much smaller than the European counterparts, and sometimes patches of kusari were used to link together plate armor, which I'll talk about plate armor next, and then draped over valuable areas such as your underarm. So if you look at that next picture, Grace, that's kusari chainmail.
And we got the hood. That's nice.
Right? And then if you look down, you see there's some shin guards as well.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, like regular chainmail in Europe, kusari chainmails could be made into literally any type of garment, jackets, hoods, gloves, vests, shin, shoulder, and thigh guards, and then even socks. Because if you're not wearing your chainmail socks, some cheeky bastard could poke his spear through your foot and you're real fucked out on the battlefield. That brings me to rigid armor styles, also known as plate armor. Plate armor is sort of exactly what it sounds like. It's armor made of bronze, iron, or steel plates, essentially, like little pieces of metal, oftentimes overlapping or sitting in large sheets. Plate armor culminates into the iconic, quote, suit of armor. So if you're familiar with the Middle Ages or, you know, medieval England or Europe at all, then I'm sure you've seen at some point a huge suit of armor. That is plate mail. Okay? Initially, it's a classic. Initially, plate armor was just an extension of chainmail, or at least it was worn in conjunction with chainmail. Like I mentioned before, the Japanese kusari chainmail might be linked with plate armor for further protection. You can see this in traditional Japanese tatami armor, which is plates of metal interwoven with chainmail, which is the next photo. Which is just a really, it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Sorry, listeners listening on the radio. Come over to YouTube.
Picture like a chainmail shirt with little gold like plates woven into it.
Yes. And if you're familiar with samurai armor, you can kind of picture like that shaping.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that helps. I kind of had some familiarity with samurai armor. Anyway, another way that you could use chainmail with plate mail was with like a muscle cuirass, which was essentially a metal shirt. So instead of it being like a regular linen shirt or like a leather cuirass, like shirt from neck to waist, it was metal. You would fit it over your shoulders to protect your chest and back, and you would wear it over chainmail. And you can see, Grace, in the picture that I sent you, the metal plates was designed in a way that you could see the nipple. And
yeah, as nipples and belly buttons.
Yes. So this is actually like a specific type, like from a very specific era, like mm-hmm. the Renaissance time, which the armor would used to be made like a la antica, essentially, mm-hmm. which is in the shape of antiquity. Mm-hmm. And so in the Renaissance, they were obsessed with like Greeks and like whatever. So they tried to like make all of their armor look like statues, like Greek statues.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some armor, some cuirasses that are like plate armor where the nipples are pierced. I kid you not. I kid you not. Anything to like freak out the person you're fighting.
Yeah. Add a couple extra nipples on there. Like a dog.
Then they're really confused. Yeah. Okay. So Roman legionnaires wore what was called lyrica segmentata, which is essentially, it's a cuirass. So again, it's a shirt. It's kind of like, the best way I can describe it is sort of like a corset that ties in the front, mm-hmm. and it's these metal sheets that kind of get connected, and they're tied with leather in the front, and this culminates into like big shoulder pads that are also made of like strips of leather as well, to protect your shoulders. And I think a lot of people are familiar with what Roman legionnaires wore, either because you've seen Troy or something or other. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty common, or I don't know. Popular is not the right word. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I've seen it before. I feel like you see it in movies and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the layered.
Yes.
The layered look.
Yeah, and they got the corset front, mm-hmm. of course. They really needed to push up their busts. Okay, so then let's go. Plate armor was very common in the late Middle Ages, so the late 14th century, and remained common until the decline of the usage in the 17th century, which was due to the development of gunpowder. In Europe, you would have started seeing complete suits of plated armor after 1420, and each suit of completed, like, plate armor would consist of, buckle in, a helmet, a gorget, which is essentially neck protection, pauldrons, which is shoulder protection, and they mm-hmm. also could have guard braces, which would then also protect your armpit. Then you would have rondelles, which is a different type of armpit protection. Cotares, which protects your elbows. Vam braces, which protects your forearms. Gauntlets protect your hands. A cuirass, which is your breastplate and backplate. A fald, which protects your hips. The tassets, which protects the thigh. A cullet, which protects the butt. A mail skirt. A cuissus, which protects a different part of the thigh. The pollens, which protects the knees. Greaves, which protects the legs. Sabatons, which protect the foot, and like I said, a helmet, which as helmets evolved through time, they covered more and more of your face until finally only your eyes were available, like, to be seen, and then mm-hmm. a lot of them have full face coverage, and you can only, like, there's like little holes poking through, so you can see. It's kind of crazy. What's the next? Okay. The fullest set of armor, all the pieces together, is called a garniture. And they were usually used for tournaments like jousting, but they were they had functionality where you could like swap pieces out so that you could change what you'd use it for. So the most decorative full pieces of like, you know, suits of armor you would just wear to like your fencing or, you know, jousting tournaments. But then you could like switch out the pants and like ride your horse in it. Or like mm-hmm. you could switch out the breastplate and like go to battle and like be on your feet and like be in battle.
Mm-hmm.
And these full sets of armor could weigh approximately 33 to 55 pounds, depending on the material used and the level of ornamentation. That's kind of heavy.
I was wondering how much these things weighed, but it's actually not as much as I thought it would be.
Right. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just a second.
Okay.
First, we're going to talk about some ornamentation. Because if you've ever been to, like, an art museum, like, for instance, like, literally any art museum, they often have like an armory wing where you can see like full plate armor, which is really cool. And some of them, especially ones that are, you know, from nobility or like high knights or whatever, they're super ornamented or just like really beautiful. And you're like, why did they do this? A lot of times the reason that they like put ornamentation onto their armor is because it was so full coverage that you couldn't tell who the F was inside. So you needed to like know who was inside so they would like ornament it, which I thought was really cool. And it's also another way to like scare your opponents too, because some, depending on what culture you're in, you might put certain types of ornamentation that are like, some face masks were like, samurai face masks had like crazy like looking faces so that you would scare your opponents, or like Germany would have like big spikes and things like that, or in Tibet they put like wards to ward against evil. So plate armor opened many possibilities for decoration and varying techniques such as paint, embossing, etching, engraving, gilding, inlay, among many others. In the late 15th century in Germany, or in German-speaking territories, they would decorate their armor with raised ridges and grooves. So the next two photos you see there, Grace, are German, some German armor. You can see like how they have different grooves and stuff on it, and it's inlaid with gold, which is really nice as well.
And they also accentuate the butt crack in the back.
Yes, yes, because you need to protect your butt.
You do.
In Italy, armorers began producing armor al antica, which I talked about already, like in the likeness of antiquity. So this next piece of armor was an Italian helmet, and on this helmet, if you keep scrolling, you see that there's a siren, like upside down, holding the strands of hair of Medusa, which is really freaking cool. And then you saw the muscle cuirass from earlier, which has like the actual chest carved into the iron. That is a la antica as well. Throughout the 16th century, English royal workshops also produced armor for English monarchs. And if you scroll to the next photo, that is one of the most beautiful full pieces of armor that I've ever seen. And it's like, it's entirely etched. It's gilded.
Why does it look like it's like Louis Vuitton?
Exactly.
It looks like Louis Vuitton on it.
Well, I think Louis Vuitton pulls from some of their like influence from some of this. Like I'm not into fashion like the way I used to, but there are some high fashion or haute couture collections that pull inspiration from armor, also from like Joan of Arc, like that kind of era of stuff. And this very much, listeners, I'm telling you, you got to tune into the YouTube. It looks very much like Mr. Vuitton himself would put this on the runway. I also like the detail underneath this, like the hip protection. You can see that like there's like red velvet kind of cushion thing.
You got to have a cushion there.
You got to have the cushion. So there's a couple other pictures here. They're basically just some Tibetan ornamentation that you might see on Tibetan like armor. A lot of this is from the armor that they would put on their war horses, so the saddle or like a chest plate for a horse. And cute. The most common form of decoration that you would see on Tibetan armor during like the 14th, 15th, 16th century was a compilation of scroll work, so like ivy and plants and like all this stuff. And on top of that, you would see dragons, because dragons were like a form of protection, which is kind of cool. And it's just gorgeous. And it's also kind of sad and scary to think about these poor horses that had to go right off into war.
I know, and they have their little chest plate. I mean, and the poor humans, too.
Oh, of course, but definitely. But
the horses really had no idea what was going on.
Could you imagine being that horse and being like, what in the goddamn hell is even happening right now?
Well, I always wonder about horses in movies that have to, like, go to war in movies. Do they know that they're acting?
I hope so. Those poor babies. Anyway, I'm going to end with debunking three myths that you may think you know about armor. Okay. There's a great article on the Met Museum. It's called Arms and Armor: Common Misconceptions and Frequently Asked Questions by Dirk H. Briding. Okay. And Dirk debunks more myths than I'm going to relay right now. I'm going to focus on three main myths. The first being, Armor was worn only by knights. Wrong. You're wrong if you thought that armor was only worn by knights, okay? First thing to understand, wars weren't fought exclusively by knights. It wasn't like you had, like, 10,000 knights riding up against another 10,000 knights. Knights had, like, foot soldiers, pikemen, crossbowmen, and, like, other sorts of infantry that would surround them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, to just assume that these pikemen or footmen wouldn't also have some form of protection, like, no, they might not be rolling around in full suits of armor or, like, full plate mail, but a lot of these were seasoned soldiers, or they would have picked up, you know, armor along the way, whether it's leather or some form of chainmail, some plate mail, a helmet here or there. They all wore armor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Myth number two, women of earlier times never fought in battle or wore armor. Wrong. That's wrong. There are many references of women participating in armed conflicts throughout most of history. These are mostly references to noble women turned to military leaders out mm-hmm. of necessity, or because they damn near wanted to. One such woman was the Countess Jean de Penedevere.
Mm-hmm.
Also Joan of Fleming, I think she might be called. She was from 1319 to 1384. So she was like a big military commander, and there's depictions of her wearing armor, which is very cool. Another famous woman who wore armor was Joan of Arc. It said that her suit of armor was actually commissioned for her by King Charles VII, which you can listen about in episode 80, where I talk about Joan of Arc. Fight Like a Girl is the name of the episode. So yeah, women were wearing armor. And then myth number three, armor is extremely heavy and renders the wearer immobile. Wrong.
Wrong again.
Like I mentioned earlier, a suit of armor might weigh at its heaviest 55 pounds. A helmet might weigh at its heaviest 8 pounds, okay? This is less than the full equipment of a fireman with oxygen gear, and what most modern soldiers have to carry into battle since the 19th century, okay? And additionally, while most modern equipment is chiefly suspended from shoulders or the waist, the weight of a well-fitted armor is distributed all over the body. It was not until the 17th century that the weight of field armor, like, severely increased to the point of, like, immobility. And the reason in the 17th century it increased is because that's when gunpowder was being developed. And so armorers were trying to figure out, how the hell can I protect people wearing bronze or, like, iron out in the field against, like, a musket? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they phased out armor entirely because it did not hold up against gunpowder. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Also, the idea that armor made you immobile is untrue. A harness of plate armor was made up of each individual element for each limb. Remember what I just said, like, I don't know, 5 minutes ago, going through every mm-hmm. single piece of armor. Because every single piece of armor was individual, it afforded you flexibility. It wasn't like your arm was, like, rigid in one mm-hmm. long piece of iron. You had mobility and flexibility to move all your limbs. And they were, like, linked by movable rivets or leather straps. And it would take a while. You'd have to put one piece on, and then you'd have your squire tie it in the next piece, and the next piece, and mm-hmm. the next piece, and so on and so forth. There's also a historical record that tells us of a famous knight, Jean de Mongri, from 1366. He was a knight who, in full armor, was able to climb up the underside of a ladder using only his hands. This man Whoa. Could do it all. He could wear armor. He could climb up a ladder. You name it.
Ladies, if he could, he would. Is that what they say?
Amen. Amen.
Oh, no. If he wanted to, he would. That's what it is.
Hey, I bought it. It worked. I also read there's, like, a myth that people think, well, I mean, hey, if you think this, now's your time to change your thinking, that knights would have to be lifted into their saddles by, like, a crane because they couldn't. Mm-hmm. move, because their armor, one, was too heavy, and two, like, rendered them immobile. And the reason this became so popular is apparently because Laurence Olivier put in his film Henry V, I think, mm-hmm. a depiction of the king being hoisted onto his saddle with a crane because he couldn't move in his armor. And a bunch of, like, historians and, like, British historians were like, please don't do this. This is not true. And he did it anyway. And so now people think you have to be hoisted onto your mount.
I kind of like that chaos. It's not hurting anyone.
It's not hurting anybody. Just history. Who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
Anyway, so I hope I debunked some myths. I hope I made you curious. Curiouser and curiouser about your armor wearage out there.
I certainly am.
And that's all I got for armor.
That's it and that's all. Alrighty.
All right.
My topic comes from the Friday, March 25th New York Times by Evans Clinchy. 27 across, where to see license plates that say greatest snow on earth?
Utah.
Yes, but my topic is on license plates.
Oh, I love this.
And I'm sorry to our listeners who aren't in the U.S. because I'm going to be focusing mostly on U.S. license plates, but maybe you'll still find it interesting. Who knows?
Hopefully.
Anything's possible.
Mm-hmm.
All right. American license plates. When cars first appeared in the U.S., license plates didn't exist. People were just driving around willy-nilly.
Loose as a goose.
Mm-hmm. But picture this. It's 1901. Mm-hmm. Some people had cars, but most people were still in a horse and buggy. And since people generally don't like new things, automobile owners would be harassed. The journal Turf, Field, and Farm called cars an unnatural vehicle. And according to the New York Times, quote, automobilists found that in many instances, they were not accorded equal rights with the drivers of horses. And the confusion resulting from these various laws led to the need of a uniform standard.
Okay. So,
automobile owners were happy when New York Governor Benjamin Odell Jr. signed into law a bill that required owners of cars to register with the state and bear, quote, the separate initials of the owner's names placed on the back of the car.
Interesting. That was the first license plate.
It was your initials. People were happy about this because now it was like, it made it more official.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing was that the state didn't give out license plates, so people had to make their own.
Oh my
God. So some would use metal house letters on leather or wood, and others even just painted the letters directly onto their vehicles, which is probably what I would do.
Yeah.
But this didn't work for too long because people had the same initials, so it wasn't that helpful.
Of course, of course.
So 2 years later, in 1903, Massachusetts was the first state to have state-issued license plates. And they started with the number one and went up from there.
Of course.
Fun fact, Frederick Tudor, he worked on the Highway Commission. He was issued the very first license plate number one, and one of his relatives still holds an active registration for this one plate today.
That's so
there's
cool.
Someone driving around Massachusetts with just the number one on their license plate.
Okay, hold on. Not to derail you, but I don't know if you remember this, but the Ice King, his last name was Tudor, and he was from Massachusetts. I wonder.
Yes. No, it is. It's him. Or it's his, like,
they're
descendant.
They're fat.
Yes.
Oh. This is like Benny Franks. We got the Ice King. We got Benny Franks. They're, you cannot escape some of these characters.
They keep showing up.
They keep showing up.
But yeah, I wonder if they get pulled over a lot, or if, like, maybe they live in a small town and everyone knows.
But oh, my God.
Fun.
That's amazing.
But, you know, those plates at the time don't look anything like license plates today. They used to be made out of iron and covered in porcelain enamel, but the size of the plate wasn't consistent. So the plate got longer and longer as, you know, you start from one, then you're in the thousands. So it was like,
yeah,
they were a mess.
Yeah.
By 1918, all U.S. states had begun issuing their own vehicle registration plates. And they were pretty boring. For example, the Massachusetts plates was just a blue background with white numbers with Mass Automobile Register written at the top.
Hmm.
It wasn't until 1928 that a state first started putting slogans on their plates. It was none other than Idaho, who stamped Idaho potatoes on every plate. Not much of a slogan, but
no,
it was
but
a start.
The potato, what's it called? Super PAC was like, hey.
Yeah.
Get us on here.
We gotta put ourselves out there.
We gotta.
And then a lot of states start to do it.
Okay.
In 1931, Pennsylvania was the first state to allow drivers to personalize their plates.
31, you said?
Yes. With their initials. That was, they couldn't do anything like, you know, they couldn't write like
Bilo Forces or whatever. Something. Okay.
Yeah. For an extra fee. Was it a way to make extra money? That was the beginning
Always.
Of vanity plates.
Oh,
which I love vanity plates,
yes.
But I paid for, like, not the standard Illinois plate. It's, like, one for fish conservation. I got it because it has a bass on it, and it looks funny. But I love seeing vanity plates and trying to like decipher what they mean, especially when sometimes you can't tell because they have vowels taken out. It like could mean multiple. We saw one.
You remember that one at King's Spa that like
stumped all of us? I wish you took a picture of it.
I can remember
what it was.
I have an Instagram story of it, so I will send it to you later.
Okay, maybe we'll post. Well, actually, I don't know if we should post someone's license plate in our
True, but still, it's hilarious.
During World War II in 1944, there was a metal supply shortage, so license plates from this time were made out of materials like fiberboard, cardboard, and even soybean-based plastic. So, you know, people who, like, collect license plates, it's kind of cool to like, kind of, you know, go back and see our history is told through these license plates.
Yeah, just like our armor.
Exactly. It wasn't until 1957 that there was a meeting of world governments to finally be like, let's set a standard license plate size.
The so world was Europe like, enough, you're done, get together, figure this out.
I mean, I can't imagine what it was like before. And how do you even affix it to the car? Because now it's like, you know, everyone has the two holes in the same spot.
But exactly.
That's why European license plates all look the same. And then, of course, the US, we have to be different. So ours are 12 by 6 inches, for anyone wondering. In 1971, manufacturing company 3M introduced high-intensity grade reflective sheeting. States began to require plates to be made out of this to improve visibility. So that's why you can see them so well in the dark. And there used to be a time where a license plate would show police codes, congressional districts, and the county that a person was from to make it easier for police to identify them. But by the 1990s, like, all that stuff was computerized and police were required to have computers in their cars. So they stopped doing that.
Makes sense.
But let's talk about different standard plates designs over the years. And standard plate is, you know, the ones that you get for free. You have to pay extra if you want, like, a bass plate like me. And typically, those types of vanity plates, it's, like, the money you pay that goes to that. Like, for example, mine went to bass conservation, which I'm happy to do.
She's happy. She talks about it all the time, actually.
I do. So I'm going to talk about just, like, the, you know, general ones that the plates that
should
states
I open
are
putting
this
picture thing first?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
So, firstly, I want to say that between 1996 and 1980, most states would come out with a new standard plate every year. And oftentimes they would reflect any big event that happened that year in that state, like if you hosted the Olympics, if you had a World's Fair. And in my opinion, that's kind of cool to have a different one every year.
Yeah.
Like, but since the 80s, they stopped doing that. Basically a state comes out with a new plate like one or two every decade, sometimes even longer than that.
Boring.
So, yeah, I agree. Except for Louisiana. Recently, they have been releasing new designs in the past couple of years. So
okay, Louisiana is like on it.
We love to see it. Some states have always kept the same slogan or vibe over the years. Shout out to Delaware. But others can't seem to decide what to do. They're trying out different slogans. Trying out different pictures, but let's get into it alphabetically. Yes. By the way, this is all from licenseplateroom.com/slogans. I sent the link to Chelsea. I will link it in the description in case you want to open it or see it later, because obviously it's easier to see the photos. Okay. I'm not talking about every state because that would take too much time.
All right.
But I'm going to talk about some interesting things.
Let's do it.
Alabama. Since 1955, Alabama has had Heart of Dixie on their plates. Sometimes it's like hugely written across the top. Other times it's inside of a little heart. But sometimes recently they tried to add second slogans onto the plate, like Stars Fell On and Sweet Home. But in my opinion, one slogan per plate.
It's enough. You can't even tell. Like, you have to zoom in so far to see the hearts of Dixie thing. And I feel
you
like, honestly, Sweet
shine.
Home makes the most sense at this point.
Sweet Home is cute. Some states have really cute ones. I hope you're looking ahead.
I haven't looked ahead yet.
Okay.
I like the Heart of Dixie, like, on the yellow plate, like the older Alabama one. I just really like how vintage that looks.
I know. Some is sad, like, some of the older plates are so cute, and it's like, why did you ever change that?
You idiots! Okay.
Okay, so Alaska flip-flopped between North to the Future and the Great Land, but since 1981, they have all had the last frontier. That's what they agreed on.
Okay, #colonialism.
Interesting about Alaska, yeah. When license plates first came out and were required, Alaska only made a couple because it was very rare to have a car up there. You know,
sure.
They weren't able to get cars up there. So a couple years ago, an original Alaska plate was bought by a collector for $60,000. There are only four of the original Alaska plates in existence because a lot of them, like, you know, Alaska's really tough environment. They, like, disintegrated over the years. So
yeah, that one cool. Right now, the blue one with the the bird on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool.
I know. Some of them are very nice. Okay. Arizona. Since 1947, Arizona has always had Grand Canyon State written on their plates. Interestingly, none of the plates have ever actually had a picture of the Grand Canyon.
It's always just like a cactus.
Yes.
These are cute.
California. I am disappointed in you. Only in 1982, Sunshine Option Plate, did you have your cool and widely known slogan, the Golden State, with a sunset and a retro design. Every other plate since has just been white with California written in red.
Why are boring. You so boring?
And like, people actually know the California State slogan, you know?
Yes.
You should put that on there.
Utilize that.
The sunset one?
Isn't it's really nice, yes. It's really nice.
Ugh. Okay. Colorado doesn't have a slogan either. For a couple of years, they used colorful, but that was about it. Also disappointed you.
It's funny they use colorful on like one, like, they're not ugly looking the plates, least colorful. But there's no color. You know what I'm saying? Like, what do you mean?
Delaware is also boring, but I applaud them for consistency. A blue plate with white writing and the slogan, The First State, has been around since 1969.
What else do you need?
With very minor changes.
So they standard. Know what they want. Yeah.
Florida. Okay, maybe I'm biased, but I think Florida has one of the best license plates. It's an outline of Florida behind an orange, and since the beginning, most editions have had Sunshine State written on
it.
But I
love
that orange look.
I know, and it has the flowers, the orange flowers as well. So, like, it's not just the orange fruit, but the flower from the plant as well, which is really cute.
Yeah, it's cute. It's like white, green, orange. Mm-hmm. Georgia, you can learn from Florida. You have a very cute peach, but you very rarely, I mean, a couple of designs have had peaches, but they haven't committed to it.
Come on.
Could have been, like, brought more to the forefront.
Yeah.
From 1940 to 1970, they had Peach State written on it, and they stopped using it until 2012. They brought it back. But during that long slogan-free hiatus, they featured one new slogan in 1997, On My Mind, based on the hit song, Georgia On My Mind.
What hit song? What are you talking about?
Georgia On My Mind is a famous song. But it's random how, like, they don't go with slogans for years, and then one year they're like, let's put On My Mind.
Let's just
and then,
do it.
Yeah, then they're like, actually,
I want to know who is on the board making these decisions.
Well,
how do we get on that board? Do I have to run for office? What do I do?
They don't come out with new ones because it's, like, too hard to agree on something.
Do you think it's, like, a statewide referendum, and, like, they have to put it in, and, like, the reason, like, nobody
probably
does it?
Yeah, probably so hard to get approved, and these people have no taste. I'm sorry, I hate to say it.
Idiots.
Hawaii, they have taste, though. I love what you've done. Since 1991, they came out with a rainbow license plate design. All of their plates say Aloha State, but that's been the design since 1991. It still is the one today.
It's cute.
Never change it.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Okay, Idaho. They were the first state to have their slogan, as we talked about. But their 1948 plate is iconic. It says World Famous Potatoes, in all caps, potatoes only, with a picture of a baked potato split open with a cube of butter.
It's so weird.
That is the best plate I've ever seen.
Like, the fact that it has the pat of butter is the icing on top of the cake.
I feel like that's one that a lot of collectors want. Mm. Since 1957, they lost the potato image and changed their slogan to just Famous Potatoes.
Okay.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Illinois.
I love that it's
boring.
Like World Famous Potatoes.
Yeah. Illinois is boring, but I had to talk about it because
we're here.
We live here. Since 1954, Illinois plates have said Land of Lincoln, but it wasn't until 2001 when they decided to actually include a bust of Lincoln's face.
Mm. I like that purple one, though. That's cool.
I know.
If they just kept it purple, but they got to put Lincoln's face on it? Come on. I mean, I get it, whatever. Land of Lincoln, but it's boring.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Okay, Indiana cannot find a slogan that works for them. Over the years, they've tried Drive Safely, Lincoln Year, Safety Pays, Heritage State, Hoosier State, Wander, Back Home Again, Hoosier Hospitality, Amber Waves of Grain, and the Crossroads of America, and now it's just www.in.gov.
What the F?
And this is a bone to pick, why are you putting your state website or your tourism website on the license plate? Who is going to get referred to the website from a license plate?
Honestly, I want to speak to their social media manager and see how many conversions they're getting from license plates and how they track that.
There's no
way.
It makes no sense, and it's ugly. but it just makes me laugh that Indiana literally went through so many different slogans.
And like, honestly, their slogans are so bad. And like the whole the Crossroads of America just makes it seem like literally nobody ever wants to stop here. We just you cross right through. Oh my God.
Okay. Iowa. Iowa was brave enough to use a slogan only once in 1953. It tried the Corn State, but it hasn't used a slogan since.
Oh no. The Corn State.
They could have fun with corn.
They could have an ear of corn on here.
This is what I... Okay, the perfect license plate is just like plain white background with something, an image in the middle. So in Iowa, it could be corn. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kansas. For some reason, Kansas has decided to lean into their Wheat State slogan with plates that say the Wheat State and Wheat Centennial, whatever that means, even though their other state slogan is the Sunflower State. Please reconsider
Please.
What you're leaning into.
We're on our hands and knees begging you.
Imagine how cute that would be.
Imagine for every zero on a license plate, they put a sunflower. Whatever. They don't ask us these questions.
Okay, Louisiana. They've basically kept Sportsman Paradise since the 1950s.
What a weird...
In 1954, they had a yams-based plate, which is famous among collectors. Like, random. but I do appreciate Louisiana because if they have something big that year, like a bicentennial anniversary, they will come out with a new plate.
What about LouisianaTravel.com? That's a good one. Jesus Christ.
I know. I don't know
Who
why.
Approves these?
I'm sure it's like a whole thing. I mean, it's a state.
Yeah.
Maine has never strayed from their 1936 slogan, Vacation Land. Okay? You will not rip that away from them.
But and I'm sorry. It's like, yeah, maybe in 1930 you were Vacation Land.
I've never been to Maine. I've never had a vacation there. But they never should have changed from their 1990 lobster plate. That's
it's so
the kind
cute.
Of stuff. It's just a lobster in the middle. Plain, simple, but we know it's Maine.
We know it's you.
That's what I like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maryland. Maryland would never be caught dead putting their state slogan, Old Line State, on their plates. They keep it simple. In 2006, they put the state website on their plates. And then in 2010, they released one honoring the 20th anniversary of the War of 1812. So that's what Maryland's up to.
The War of whatever. I'm sorry, that's like one of the least popular wars. Next.
Tell me about it. Okay, Massachusetts, the first state to ever issue plates, and they've kind of kept it simple ever since then. They still have blue and white plates. And then in 1993, they slapped on the spirit of America, and that's Massachusetts.
Truly, when you put one toe into Massachusetts, you really are imbued with the true, true feeling of America, the true homecoming, as we like to call it. We call it that on the East Coast, the homecoming. For any British folks out there, if you land in Massachusetts, just say, this is the homecoming.
And everyone will understand. Yeah. Okay. Minnesota. Since 1950, their license plates will remind you that they have 10,000 lakes. That's all it says. Just 10,000 lakes on the Minnesota license plate.
Okay. I like the one that says Water Winter Wonderland. Oh, wait. We're in Minnesota. Sorry. I was looking at... I'm sorry.
I was like, wait a minute. That's not Minnesota. That's Utah.
Michigan. Sorry.
Michigan. All right. Missouri. Missouri also keeps it simple. They are not honoring anniversaries. Oh, keep it simple. If they're not honoring anniversaries, their plates say, Show Me State, which is the Missouri state slogan. I don't know what that means, but...
It's kind of vulgar.
Yeah. Show me.
Show me. I dare you.
I skipped Michigan, but yeah, Michigan was like...
No, it's okay.
It was like Water Wonderland, Winter Wonderland. Then they did Water Winter Wonderland.
They did
I believe.
They did it.
You know, they got to cross out all their bases.
They got to. They got lots of stuff going on over there.
Okay, Nebraska. Between 1956 to 1965, Nebraska had the famous slogan, the Beef State, on their license plate.
Okay.
Amazing. Sadly, after that, they stopped using it. They had Corn Husker State a couple times. They celebrated the bicentennial statehood, blah, blah, blah. Boring. Bring back the Beef State. Thank you
Bring
very much.
Bring it back. Yeah.
Nevada. They were slow to put slogans on their plates. It took until 1985 when they started printing the Silver State.
Okay.
But in 2016, they took a risk and they came out with a colorful mountain range plate and the new slogan, Home Means Nevada.
It's cute.
I like that. Yeah.
It's cute.
They took a risk and it paid off, in my opinion. New Hampshire. New Hampshire's, they're wild. Okay. They're the Granite State. They've never used that on a license plate.
Okay.
Since 1971, it has used the motto, live free or die, which is kind of a vibe. And
yeah.
It's a quote attributed to New Hampshire's Revolutionary War hero, General John Stark.
If you don't know John Stark, I don't know what to tell you.
There was actually like a Supreme Court case on a guy who didn't want to have live free or die because he said it went against his religion. And then, I don't know, he got to like use another plate for free.
Okay.
All right, next we gotta do New Jersey. Always reliable, Garden State has appeared on every plate since 1959.
It's true. It's really, truly a boring license plate, but it is like, you know, it's
sometimes
got the yellow.
Like the classic.
Yellow to white ombre. You got the state outline, and that's it.
This is my favorite license plate, New Mexico.
The New Mexico license plates are amazing. Seeing them in person was amazing. Yeah. You gotta love
it. Okay, so they have like the land of enchantment. That's their motto.
It's amazing.
They have the best base colors, in my opinion.
They do.
They're kind of like Mexican inspired. They have yellows, corals, teals, oranges.
It's amazing.
Even like now, they have like three standard plates for free. One is like teal with yellow on it. The other is yellow with teal, I believe. But then they have a third standard plate option that has two chilies with the quote, chili capital of the world.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And the background is black, which is really cool, too.
I feel like I still like the teal with the yellow on
it. I agree.
But it's like, imagine living in a state where you're deciding between three amazing design options to use.
I know.
For
one of the main reasons to move to New Mexico is for this. And this
there you have it. Okay, New York. New York has pretty much stuck with Empire State.
Mm-hmm.
In 1938 and 64, they had World's Fair plates.
Okay.
I'm asking you again, bring back the yearly plate design based
Seriously.
On events that happened that year.
Yes.
In 2020, New York released new plates that say Excelsior, which is the state motto meaning ever upward, with a picture of Niagara Falls on one side and the New York City skyline on the other.
Okay.
My idea for the New York State, Statue of Liberty in the middle.
Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like all upstate New York would be so pissy about that.
True. They could do a big apple. A big apple with a... They still wouldn't like it, but...
They still wouldn't like it. Whatever. What can we do? We can't win everything.
Can't do much. Okay, North Carolina. They started with First in Freedom in 1975, but then they switched to First in Flight after the Wright brothers. But in 2015, they reintroduced the option to get First in Freedom instead. So, which one are you? First in Flight or First in Freedom?
First in Flight. I mean, honestly.
Yeah. That's... You can, like... There's two different types of people in North Carolina. The ones who get First in Flight and the ones who get
First
in Freedom.
Freedom.
Yeah, we're First in Flight
people. The girls who get it, get it. The girls who don't, don't. That's all you're going to say about it.
Ohio, another state that couldn't decide what slogan they want to go with. My favorite is the 1974 plates that said, seatbelts fastened,
Okay. Oh my God.
They also
what
tried.
What's going on with their current one? It's so bad.
I'll tell you. Okay. So they also tried the heart of it all. They tried the birthplace of aviation. In 2013, they just said screw it and they printed a plate full of slogans written in light gray on a white background. So it's like a white license plate. And then just in the background in gray, it's just like 20 slogans.
It's bad, guys.
It was culled from the public. So they had like, they're just tell us whatever and we're going to put everything on because they couldn't decide.
At least they polled the public.
They did. Okay. Oh, Oklahoma. God. For a couple of plates, they used to have Oklahoma is okay.
It's actually
which
cute.
I love. Yes.
It's so cute.
They don't do that anymore. In Pennsylvania in 1984, their plates used to say, you've got a friend in Pennsylvania.
That's
but
cute.
A new governor decided he didn't like that and replaced it with Keystone State.
Which
today,
governor was this?
It says visitpa.com. Why? You're telling me that's better than you've got a friend in Pennsylvania?
It's how not. Many conversions are you getting? Give me your analytics now.
Rhode Island, they've changed up their things, but since 1980, the plate has always had an anchor and the slogan Ocean State. They've changed up where it is, but it always has an anchor.
Okay.
South Carolina, their slogan is the Palmetto State, and the Palmetto tree has made it onto almost every plate.
Okay.
In 1999, they had a slogan, Smiling Faces, Beautiful Places, which I love.
Cute.
But now they have, While I Breathe, I Hope. I don't know what that means, but
I have no idea. Whatever that means.
Mm-hmm. South Dakota. They are putting Mount Rushmore in every single plate every time with the slogan, great faces, great places, which I don't like. I don't like Mount Rushmore, but I do like great faces, great places.
Yeah, no, that's a great slogan. You know, the plates just look bad.
They do.
They're too busy. They're too busy.
Okay. In Tennessee, in 2001, they had Tennessee Sounds Good to Me with the sun setting over the state of Tennessee.
It's cute. That's cute.
Cute.
Yes.
But now it's ugly and it just says tnvacation.com.
Y'all are dumb. I'm sorry. Okay. Get me on the phone with these governors. I need to talk to them.
Okay. Utah, from the clue, their current plate is greatest snow on earth with a skier and a second slogan, life elevated. They did a double slogan. They have had cuter desert design.
The desert design
inspired
is,
plates in the past, in my
it's
opinion.
So much cuter. It has like a mesa type look, and the skier is just bad.
It's all white.
It's not as graphic, you know? Like, if you're going to have some sort of design, it needs to be very graphic and visual. Like, the Mount Rushmore ones are it's in that kind of grayed out font in the back, you know? The skier's in the back. It's grayed out. It's like you can't really see what's going on. I'm telling you, you need a real graphic designer in there.
Florida
not Jimmy
Two
Shoes from the office down the hall.
Not like an oil painter illustrator. You need like a graphic, like the Florida orange. I'll say it again. It's perfect.
I hope somebody in some office is listening to this and gives us a call, because we will consult. We'll consult. We are.
I got ideas for every state.
Yeah.
Okay. Virginia. It took them until 2014 to put Virginia is for lovers on their plates, but it's there. It's the current plate, and the V in lovers is a red heart.
That is insanely adorable. I wish they could have done it a little bigger, because it's a little bland, but the slogan is amazing.
Imagine they had a heart in the middle of the cute. Okay.
Don't even. Okay.
Wisconsin, another state that's sure of itself. They've had America's Dairyland since 1940. Classic Wisconsin.
They're milky and proud.
Wyoming, they don't always have slogans, but they always have had a bucking bronco, which
I
love that for them.
It is amazing. That's what we're talking about with a graphic design. This is perfect.
Easy to see. Easy outline. Okay.
Finally,
I'm going to end with Washington, D.C. They have their own plates, mostly saying things like nation's capital and a capital city. But in 2000, they released one that has taxation without representation.
What does that even mean?
Well, because D.C. doesn't have a senator. They don't have representation there. But they still have to pay taxes.
I see.
So
it's kind of snarky.
It is. And then like a couple years ago, they have one that says end taxation without representation.
Okay. I think end taxation without representation makes more sense than just plain, just a statement. Just if I walked up to you and I said taxation without representation, you're like, what does that mean?
At first they were like, this is just what's going on here. And then they were like, no, this is what we want to do about it. But yeah, so it's actually interesting. I went down a rabbit hole and then I had to drive some more today. I was like looking at all the license plates.
Have you ever played the license plate game?
No.
When I was in high school with a friend, we played a game that we would like try to get every single license plate, like to see every single license plate and just record it in like our notes app. And it only counted if we were together in the car. So like if she was driving by herself and saw Alaska, it didn't count. Or if I was by myself and I saw Hawaii, it didn't count, you know? And we got, it's funny because we got Hawaii and we got Alaska, but there was other states that we never got.
How'd you get Hawaii?
You can fly your cars.
I guess.
Isn't that crazy? Or you can bring your plates or I don't know.
Ferry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Anyways, states, do better, please. Some of your
try
designs
harder.
Are just, yeah.
Anyway, wow.
That's it.
That's
a long
it, and
that's
one.
All. I'm sweating.
We're sweating, but that was a good topic. Mm-hmm. Both of our topics were good. They're always good. And if you're curious about more topics, listen to our other episodes because they're all good.
Yeah, most of them.
We'll see. Yeah, let us know.
Yeah, let us know if you have a specialty license plate. You can talk to us on Twitter at The Good Eve Girls.
Or Instagram at The Good Evening Girls.
Or TikTok at The Good Eve Girls.
Come on down, say hello, send us pictures of your full suits of armor, of course, and your vanity plates.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Until
next time, please keep curious out there, listeners, and we will see you bright and early next week.
Bye-bye.